and welcome to this week's episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast with me, Jasmine Harrison, and I'm joined by Phil Brining and Joe Kirk once again. Hello.
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 Hello. This week's session was mastering third-party relationships, and I think we scratched the surface, to be honest. We started off going through a few news pieces, typically around the ICO and hacks and whatnot again. Just seems to be a hot topic at the moment. And then we went over to the post office. Obviously, that's been on the end of everybody's lips at the minute. And, you know, we had a big debate about it, some contrasting opinions, I might say. Phil?
There was an interesting discussion. I mean, I don't feel like I've got all the information, all the facts, you know, so it's quite hard to...
Yeah.
Everyone's got an opinion, obviously, but is it rooted in fact? I don't know. But we had quite a good discussion about it and, you know, wondered whether anything would be different under the GDPR had the project not started in 96, but, you know, 2018 or 19 or 20 or something. But it was quite an interesting discussion, that wasn't it, and all relevant to third-party relationships.
Definitely. And then we delved into due diligence, you know, which is one of our favourite topics, really, and how granular do you go, what does it entail, and then controller-to-controller relationships, which I find particularly tricky at times.
Yeah, we just scratched the surface with them talking about relationships, because there's so many different types of relationships, aren't there, with different, you know, maybe nuanced, but, you know, we talked about control to control relationships, but, you know, what controller are you talking about there? Is it an ad hoc request from another controller? Is it a proper protocol-based data sharing arrangement? Is it a data outsourced data protection officer? You know, what is the relationship that you're looking for? And then back to your point on due diligence, and therefore what would be appropriate to do in the circumstances? I think different horses for courses.
Yeah, definitely. Joe, what was your take?
Yeah, I thought it was a great session. Like you've said, it was one where we didn't really go too deep. We spent quite a bit of time trying to unpack the post office scandal, and like Phil mentioned, we couldn't quite come to a conclusion of what we felt the relationship was there. I think me and Jasmine believe that it's controller to processor, but Phil doesn't quite agree with that. So maybe we have to unpack and dig that a little bit further on a new session or on a GDPR radio session moving forward. But Phil, I thought it was a great idea when you mentioned about, you know, would the GDPR have had a different outcome. You know, we kind of explored data protection impact assessment and what that might uncover of the system itself, and we kind of came to the conclusion that, you know, it definitely would have been a more thorough investigation prior to implementing such a device nationally.
Well, whatever had the potential to be a more thorough investigation, it might be one of those superficial, gloss over the top, retrospective deep AAs, tick a box. But anyway,
yeah, depending on who filled it out.
Call me cynical, yeah.
Yeah, I think, you know, with our differences in opinion aside, the crux of it is if you're going to engage with a third party to provide a service or a software or a product, then you need to make sure that if there's information that will be used on that, that it is secure, that it is sufficient, and that you do your checks beforehand. And if you're aware of checks, you know, obviously highlight them and fix them, because obviously that wasn't done here, and it just the situation magnified tenfold.
Yeah, but it was code bugs, wasn't it? It was. I mean, if it was a breach of security, that would again be different. This. Much more difficult to establish, you know, or would seem much more difficult to establish. You know, there are definitely code bugs that are having a negative impact on the integrity of the data. That's what's happened here, you know, and exacerbated, it would seem, by, you know, old equipment and power cuts and, you know, people trying to fix stuff on the fly in the back end, you know, without necessarily modeling what's going to happen. But this is process, isn't it? This is a software design process.
It comes back to, though, as well, when this it went out to bid to have this piece of software or to provide this piece of software, and Horizon failed.
They came bottom ranked.
Yeah, they were ranked bottom in 7 out of 11 areas, and they still went with them, obviously for financial reasons, but that in itself,
because they had a track record of delivering successful projects for government.
Yeah, I think someone in the chat actually highlighted that they're responsible for, I think there was five or six systems within the government. I think HMRC was one. I think there was
DWP.
And an audit branch of the government as well was part of it. So no surprise that they won that. But, you know, hopefully, I'd like to say lessons have been learned. But with this government, we'd probably say not.
Yeah. But yeah, anyway, we'll let you get into the main part of the session. We hope you enjoy it. And yeah, I suppose stay tuned for a part two. What have you seen in the news, Phil, and you're reading?
I've seen quite a bit this week. The ICOs fined a couple of home improvement companies for breaching the PECA, that's £250,000 of fines. But the thing that really I think was a bit concerning was some of these hacks that have occurred. So an Ivanti VPN system has been hacked. So it seems like if you haven't updated your patches, then if you're using this Ivanti VPN particular version, then it's subject to insecurity, which is a bit worrying, isn't it? Because, you know, one of the key things we're looking for sometimes is, you know, how do you access in the systems? Oh, you've got a VPN tunnel, therefore it's nice and secure. Well, maybe it's not. On a similar vein, I read that TeamViewer, which a lot of people use for IT support, again, has been hacked. It got hacked in 2016. TeamViewer said it was all about weak passwords, and there was kind of, what do you call them now? Blunt brute force attacks to get in. And then once you're on the team viewer session, then you can install an encryption software and all sorts of things in people's systems. Because we use TeamViewer, don't we, for IT support? Anyway, it's happened again this week. Again, it seems to be, not so much unpatched, but, you know, weak passwords or guessable passwords or passwords that are on the dark web. Mm-hmm. Again, it highlights that, you know, you're meant to have unique passwords for everything, but then you got to remember them all. And I did read somewhere that LastPass got hacked as well recently. So again, they might store all your secure passwords in a password vault, but they're not necessarily that secure either. So I've noticed those this week. Greater Manchester Council, Tameside Council, had a data breach. Again, this seems to be a spreadsheet within a spreadsheet from a FOIA request. You know, 6,000 people's details leaked, which is not great. Again, it's driven by a badly organizing data on a FOIA request. So that was quite interesting to have a look at that. And I'm quite intrigued about this. I've been tracking this law firm called SSB that are a specialist in no-win, no-fee cases. Well, they went to the wall a couple of weeks ago, and they looks like the owners of the business might be up for unlimited fines because of what they've been doing. So seems like they've kind of said to people, no win, no fee, we've got insurance to cover these no win, no fee claims, and they haven't. And then the people who they're representing are up, you know, are a foot in the bill for the legal costs, which in some cases are about £25,000 or more. The big area that's caught them out isn't data protection, no win, no fee. It's cavity wall installation claims, no win, no fee type of arrangements. So that, I don't know if you saw that in the press, but that's really quite worrying as well.
Yeah. I want to go back to you touched on it initially, the two fines that the ICO have given to two home improvement companies. I just laughed when I read into it, really, because it's again for PECA violations of direct marketing calls, and it just seems to be, you know, constantly the fines that the ICO are providing are in relation to this. It got me thinking. So I suppose, you know, that's the biggest or the most popular type of complaint that the ICO is going to receive for, you know, to then investigate an organization and provide a fine. So it just, to me, seems that the ICO is too much of a reactive service when it comes to reinforcement. I want to get your thoughts on that. It's a reinforcement, not reinforcement.
Well, I think they are reactive. They don't have any or they don't have much proactive work. They only respond to complaints. I mean, sometimes they do a kind of a deep dive into a particular sector or industry, as they have done on ad tech. So, you know, what they're doing, I think, is quite right, taking a risk-based approach, you know. So the risk-based approach that they're taking to on ad tech is because it's prevalent, it's massive, it's intrusive, and they're saying that's a higher, you know, a high risk. And they're probably relying on the fact that if there are lots of PECA violations, that people are going to complain about them. And if they don't complain about them, they're not bothered about them. They don't take many complaints because Skeen Holmes, one of the people who got fined, only had 31 complaints about them. So, you know, you don't have to have thousands and thousands of complaints to trigger an investigation from the ICO.
I know, but it all relates to the PECA, doesn't it? I mean, how much goes under the radar in relation to GDPR that we know happens anyway? And it obviously needs that proactive approach.
Well, I think that the PECA is so easy to prove that you're in violation of it. Mm. You know, that's why it's easy for them to prosecute, and they only have to work on the balance of probabilities to secure a successful case. Demonstrating, apart from probably a security, demonstrating there's a non-compliance is just much more hard, much more difficult, isn't it? And the big question for me is, you know, do these businesses know about the PECA? Or not, you know, and are they taking a commercial decision, you know, where we'll make these calls and we'll make, you know, hundreds of thousands of pounds out of it, and the chance of getting caught are low, and therefore it's commercially viable to ride roughshod over the PECA in order to, you know, for commercial gain. I suspect that's the case, rather than them being oblivious to the fact that the PECA exists.
Yeah, definitely. When you see how many marketing communications they've sent out as well, it's absolutely ridiculous. I saw one of these that was 2.6 million unlawful marketing calls between March and July 2022. How do you even have the resources for that?
it's an automated dialer. Load the data in, and the dialer does the calling for you. If it makes a connection, it'll route it through to an agent, won't it? That's how they get through that many.
I've had some thoughts on this as well, actually, about the ICO's ability to be able to find easier on PECA. Do you think, in terms of the GDPR, it's kind of because when they get a complaint from a data subject, they kind of go back to the data controller and try and get them to resolve the issue at that instance, as opposed to
probably as well. And in my experience, the side with the data controller is much more readily than the side with the data subject.
Whereas, like you say, PECA, once you've sent out a million emails unlawfully, you know, you've already done it. You can't go back and make any amends. Whereas if you act unlawfully with someone's data, you know, you collect and process it in a way that you haven't said you would do previously, the ICO kind of puts a little bit of a thing on the data controller to go back and make amends that way, as opposed to, you know, pulling the trigger on a fine.
I say either there's an automated dialer making those calls, Jazz, or it's Rob Wilkinson, because he's a real machine. He's a real machine into with his phone call. That's why he's got short fingers. It's all that dialing he does. I'm sure of it. Now, Lawrence is mentioning in the chat about the ICO's form for raising a subject action request, which I actually used a few weeks ago to raise a subject action request on eBay. And I assumed that it would appear that the ICO had kind of been a broker in raising the subject action request, but I don't think it does. It seems like you just fill it in and the system sends it off, but it doesn't appear to come from the ICO. But I don't know what, I think that's what's being mentioned in the chat here. I wanted to use it to see what it was like. David, coming in there.
Yeah, no, we received one. Doesn't sound like we're the first. I wasn't sure whether it was how new it was. It does say on the form that it's quite a new thing. It looks like, I think Lawrence has come in and said his firm also received one. I mean, actually, yeah, it came into my team, used our official address, because you're asked
to. Well, you have to type it in the form, don't you?
Yeah. And so it used our official address, so it came into my team.
Did it look like it comes from the ICO?
Well, it comes in from no reply@ICO.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah, I mean, hold on.
Well, that is good, actually. That's probably why eBay finally responded.
Well, it has that feel, but it looks like it's an official response. I mean, and an official piece, but I personally don't think it is, of course.
No, so, I don't think it is. I think that they're just facilitating it. You know, when if you do it, you know, fill it in, raise a subject action request on yourself just to see how it works. But Lawrence has got his hand up. But
I'm like Lawrence, I'm definitely not an advocate. It looks to all intents and purposes, until you investigate, like it's a formal request on the ICO. And, you know, had we responded to it, the particular one we've got, I've got no intention in responding in the way it's been asked. I don't think a lot of what they're claiming is either A, their personal data, B, there is lots of exceptions we can use as always, that's what I do, and a number of other things. We will, of course, provide the appropriate personal data, but no, it very much does look like, I'll just see if this works, if you don't mind.
Not at all.
There you go. Can you see it?
Yeah.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah.
So it comes
that's
in.
That's interesting. Yeah.
And I'm really hoping that my team did their job and removed any personal data. So it just comes down. And yeah, so it just keeps going. Information as coffees it come in. You know, it isn't until you read really closely. You know, the more junior members in the team were a little bit concerned. I sort of said there's no case number, there's no case office. So this doesn't seem like it's, you know, it's truly been to them in that respect. Mm. And only when we sort of investigated a bit further, we found the form, which I wasn't aware of. So, yeah, I thought it was a bit interesting. Anyway, I'll let Lawrence come in.
Yeah, I was just going to say that we did the same thing. We went through the same process because I was worried it was spam or it was something like these third-party forms where they're essentially getting the person's information. Like somebody goes, oh, I have a benefits claim, or I have something going on with, you know, a children's service and my psych evaluation reports haven't been given to me and they're going to give it to this third party for the company. If you read the fine print, some of these companies are harvesting data that way. But with the ICO one, I said, look, you're going to get people confused that they're going to be, is this an official endorsed ICO request or is this simply on their platform or where is it coming from? Yeah. For all the reasons you can see on that thing. Now, I understand the reason for this is that, like you just said, it improves take up that somebody says, oh, there's an ICO request. We got to action this versus, oh, it's just from Joe Blogs. But I don't know if this is the way to do it. I don't know. I mean, I can sort of see the problem they're trying to solve in that they want to improve take up and ensure people get their rights taken care of. But are there other ways to do that short of badging it as the ICO? And then because it's not. Yeah. So.
Yeah, no, it's a good question. That in the last one, Damu's raised in the chat. Is it Damu or is it right? Vanisha, about, you know, does the ICO monitor this? You know, are they looking at it? I wouldn't have thought so. I thought it's just
no. My understanding is no. They said they don't get the response. The response doesn't come to them at all.
Yeah, there must be a database behind the website of all the requests, whether they look at it, whether the form is statistical. Oh, sorry, Vanisha, whether they publish any statistics on it. You know, that it's increasing or it's decreasing. But there'll be no loop closure for them. They won't know whether they've been adequately responded to or not because there's no way of updating it.
I suppose what they would say is that, look, if it came from the ICO and you still haven't responded, we will now be able to have you, your situation is a lot worse. That is, you're even ignoring the ICO versus, oh, we didn't get the email or it came through Yahoo and our filters blocked it out or blah, blah, blah. That's one thing I could think that they're trying to do to say, look, we know that you've got an issue here. Because I don't know if they're trying to avoid those situations where people go to those third-party platforms.
Maybe they are. The next step would be to actually to perform the subject act request, you know, the uploading of the data on their platform. I don't think they'd go that far. I can't imagine that would go that as far as to, you know, provide that kind of functionality to help people. No. But I came across that form quite a few months ago. I can't remember. It must have been like September, October time. And I was intrigued about it. I think I read about it somewhere, intrigued about it. So I went in and I raised a subject tax request on data protection people just to see what happened. I think we talked about it on a podcast. And then I found that eBay was ignoring my written subject tax request and there was no facility to actually raise any subject tax request with them. So I raised one through the ICO platform and guessed at the DPO email. I must have got one right because they then finally did respond, although they haven't responded properly. So it's still an ongoing issue for me. Anyway, yes, interesting. Another thing I saw, which was quite interesting in the news, was the National Crime Agency director. Did you see that? Who lost a job after emailing private, you know, secure emails or, sorry, confidential emails to her private email address and encouraging the use of WhatsApp and WhatsApp groups in terms of moving classified material around. Did you see that in the press?
Yeah. I think obviously the fact that she's lost her job is a positive in some ways, you know, in a backwards way reaction to her misconduct. At least it shows that, you know, they do have appropriate measures in place and are checking these things. But the fact that it was done in the first place.
She's scapegoat. Does it happen? Does it happen elsewhere in the organisation? Does the organisation aware of it?
It definitely would. It definitely would. Yeah. But I guess we're just speculating here. And another thing that's been, you know, a hot topic on everyone's lips is the post office scandal. So that is slightly relevant, you know, to today's session. So we thought we'd talk about it in a bit of detail today. Joe, you've done some research on it, haven't you? Do you want to give an overview of it for anyone who's not up to date with it?
Yeah, sure. So like Jasmine said, it has been a very much a hot topic. I did a little bit of research. I actually watched the Panorama special on it. I'm aware, obviously, there's a drama, but it's four parts and they're an hour long, I believe. So I decided just to go with it.
Half a day's work, was it?
Well, or 4 hours of my own podcast.
I need to see Friends as well, if they mention it on Friends and other TV programs too.
No, I didn't want to give up four hours of my own time. So I did decide to watch the Panorama one instead. So essentially, in the 1990s, the post office was not computerized and the government invited, I'm not sure the quantity, but several organizations, let's say, to, you know, come and bid in order to computerize post office. There was 11 categories and Horizon came bottom in 7 of the 11 categories. But it was the cheapest. The source for that was the National Audit Office report from August 2000. So the purpose of Horizon was to inform each post office at the end of the day how much money should be holding within each specific post office. So the issue came from cash and stamps were fine, but Horizon said that money was missing. Now, there's a clause in sub-postmasters' contracts that made the sub-postmasters liable for any money that went missing. It doesn't matter how this happened. If the system said it wasn't there, they had to put the money back. And it wouldn't let you open up the next day, you know, if the money wasn't in the till. So this obviously caused sub-postmasters to kind of go into a little bit of a frenzy and sort of start putting their own money in, starting to take loans out to cover these holes. And they also kind of hid it from the post office as well to kind of, you know, put a cover on fraudulent accounting. Sub postmasters declared that they had problems with Horizon, and the detectives of post office said that you're the only one that has this issue, when that wasn't the case. There was actually hundreds that were reporting it at the time. And obviously, going further into it, if you can't prove they haven't stolen the money, post office kind of gave them an exit route, saying that if you plead guilty to false accounting, we'll drop the theft charges. Obviously, you know, this was a lie as well. So the crux of the issue was that it turns out that Horizon and Fujitsu employees were able to go into the system and alter the balances on the system, and they didn't inform the sub postmasters at the post offices. So essentially, you know, whole massive, basically a scam that, you know, caused serious implications on hundreds of people within the UK. I think by 2015, there was 705 false convictions of fraud and false accounting. And, you know, people were made homeless. And I think there's even been 4 suicides that have unfortunately been linked to it as well. So, you know, it really does show, you know, the negative side of things, that if, as an organization, you don't carry out thorough due diligence, you know, it can have serious impacts on data subjects. Now, I know that this is quite an extreme case, but, you know, I just wanted to raise it and kind of talk through it with you guys, as it's been a pressing matter all around the country.
Yeah, I'm not convinced that it's like a due diligence thing, this, because ultimately, ICL, Fujitsu, I mean, this, yeah, interesting. There's a lot to unpack, isn't there? But it was design software, so it was software. So to me, you know, it's the software design, development, and testing processes that are the weak link here, not necessarily the the actual contractor. I mean, the ICL had a history of supplying mainframe computers to the Post Office and the Inland Revenue and Department for Work and Pensions, Ministry of Defence, local authorities. So they might well have been the cheapest, but also potentially had the best track record. It was a British company, and at the time there might have been politics involved. In fact, it was born out of politics, wasn't it? It was a merger in the 60s of three companies. So the industrial policy was trying to merge these companies to provide a British computer firm that could rival IBM. When it got taken over, you know, so this whole Horizon project started in May 96, I think, and Fujitsu bought the majority share of ICL in 1998. So again, how you might do due diligence on one company, if you get taken over by another, you know, what does that mean for you? You know, that might have had some kind of bearing on management structures and, you know, technical skills. There's a lot in there, isn't there, to unpack with it.
Yeah, it's a complicated case. But I think, are you saying by that that Fujitsu are not the data processor? Because, you know, even though they've just, well, it's not even just providing the software, they can access, you know, people's Horizons accounts, essentially, even though these sub-postmasters were under the impression that they were the only ones.
Yeah, I don't know enough about the case, to be honest, because I haven't seen the documentary. I've done a bit of, you know, listened to it on the radio and things, but I would have thought ICL had a history of building computer systems, mainframes initially, then, you know, mini computers and personal computers. I would have thought that the Post Office had their own computer infrastructure, and the ICL or Fujitsu were designing the software. Now, they might have had access to the platform for maintenance purposes or testing purposes or things, but whether they were actually processing, I don't know. I don't know whether a data processor, but I don't think they would be. If it was a hosted system, yeah, okay, they would be then, wouldn't they? But not sure that they are. I've seen no evidence or no discussion about it either way.
Well, I got the impression they were, because they said that the aim of Horizon was to computerize the Post Office, therefore suggesting that computers were not really a thing. And obviously,
but they weren't initially, were they?
No.
It was all done on paper.
Yeah. And obviously, if Horizon are able to let Post Office know how much money they should have within each Post Office
Horizon's
at the end
software.
Of...
Horizon's a piece of software, isn't it? Horizon's not an organization. The organization was ICL Pathway Limited. That actually built the platform, started building the platform before they're taken over by Fujitsu.
David's made a good point. He said, not sure why the balance of the post offices would be personal information.
No, but it does relate back to those that work there, doesn't it? And the owner of the post office.
I think it's that wider picture of making sure that any third parties you engage with for systems or you know, subcontracted services and whatnot, you need to make sure that you are doing the checks to ensure that the information your organisation holds, whether it's personal data or not or both, is secure and is protected and is, you know, there's no risks and gaps within
it. This isn't security though, I mean, this sounds like, reading between lines, this is like, you know, bugs and glitches. So what I've read is that it wasn't Fujitsu staff, you know, going in altering balances. It seems to me that the system Horizon hadn't been tracking money from lottery terminals or vehicles excise duty payments and cash machine transactions. So there was a whole swathe of things that potentially weren't actually programmed into the software to be added into these calculations. So I don't think that there was people logging in the back end and altering the data. They also, according to information leaked to the BBC in 2014, apparently the training on the system wasn't good enough, the equipment was old and outdated, and the power cuts and communication problems made things a lot worse as well. So there's a whole host of factors that have caused a problem, but you know, many of those, you know, communication issues, power cuts in the post offices, is that responsibility of ICL or Horizon? Probably not.
I mean, a lot of people are affected though. I don't think it would just be down to power cuts, for example. It's, you know, there's clearly issues with the software itself highlighted.
Well, maybe if the software was in the middle of a transaction and then there was an interruption to power, and that transaction never got completed, and, you know, it's not, you know, double entry accounting. So, you know, it sounds like there was deficiencies in some balances and surpluses in others. What I've read is that had somebody actually been through that and knitted it all together, they would have found that there was, you know, suspense accounts and holding accounts, it all balanced itself out, but they didn't. They're just focusing on the deficits. But, you know, if a computer got interrupted what does it do? Does it pick up the transaction when it comes back to life again? So, you know.
A couple of people have mentioned in the chat, I think this was in the Panorama episode, that a Fujitsu employee anonymously said that they were changing the data in live time and admitted to logging in the back end and changing it.
Why would you do that?
I honestly don't know.
What they said was there were, at the time, there were errors with the system. They were essentially trying to do live bug fixes. They weren't altering the balances of postmasters to put errors into their account.
Yeah.
But I think the biggest challenge was that at all points in time, the post office came back and said, this cannot happen. The postmaster cannot make changes. And what caused their case to fall apart in the end was exactly that, that Fujitsu admitted, and the post office had to admit, that they had, that Fujitsu had back-end access and could make those transactions. And there were definitely teams that they got people to admit of people making transactions, not directly on these post asset masters, but they knew there were bugs. They were trying to correct the bugs through the accounting in the back end, is what it appears. I think my favourite line in the whole thing, if you watch the four things, which is supposedly a come from it, there's a challenge in open court when the head of the post office is asked, and this was from court records as well, was asked to declare that the system was totally error free. And she went, yes, I can declare that. And he said, that's a little bit of a surprise. You must have the first IT system in the world that has ever been declared totally error free. And I think that was my favourite.
It's like people saying the GDPR compliance.
Oh, I love that one as well. But let's not go there.
I mean, the other thing is a bit surprising is it doesn't appear that it was particularly forward looking. So the initial plan was to change the paper-based system with magnetic swipe cards. And at some point, like 2 years into the project, everyone's saying, oh, crikey, you know, we can see the end of magnetic swipe cards. Well, how is that? You know, you've got this massive project run by government and a major global company. How are they not forward-looking and thinking this technology we're basing the platform on is probably going to, you know, disappear in a few years' time? I mean, they might not have foreseen phone payments, but surely would have seen chip and pin and other developments and, you know, other tokenistic kind of ways of transacting. So it seems strange, but there were lots of stepping off points as well, weren't there? So they had two projects originally with Horizon. One was for the Benefits Office and one was for Post Office, and Benefits Office bailed out of the project in 1999. Post Office decided to carry on, I think under pressure from Fujitsu. And then there was this investigation by the Second Sight forensic accountants, and they reported back that there were bugs. So there's lots of opportunities to have said, actually, you know, there's some issues here, and we could jump off this trail. And amazingly, I believe Horizon is still in use today, isn't it? Although it's being superseded very shortly.
No surprise.
Well, they might find it all out now, but once you've lost faith in it, then, you know, you've lost faith in it. But it's apparently it was their most profitable project.
I'm not surprised.
ICL and Fujitsu's most profitable project.
They're adding hundreds of thousands onto people's records. it's a complicated case, really. A friend of mine's working on the inquiry from the post office perspective. So I did ask her about what's been uncovered in terms of Horizon and Fujitsu, but she's not really she's not well fed on that side. But from her perspective, you know, it's not, this whole case isn't down to, you know, malicious people trying to destroy people's lives. It's down to the stress of budgets and financial pressures, really. And then obviously getting so deep down a rabbit hole that you're trying to dig your way.
Well, a big complicated project. I mean, that is a big complicated project, isn't it? to build and to roll out and to manage.
Yes. Well, the more important is to get it right first time, though.
I slightly agree with you there, Jasmine, but then the issue then comes from when they did find out that there was issues that were coming from, you know, the Fujitsu staff that were going in the back end, is that they tried to cover it up. And I think this in the Panorama special, the two post office lawyers shared communication with each other saying that we need to win this no matter what. And they, you know, they
you know what lawyers
well.
Are like, though.
Well, of course,
but that's
when
it gets.
I'm joking.
Why would the management kind of adopt that approach? It just seems bizarre that the management. I mean, surely you'd think at some point it's going to come out, isn't it?
I know. Yeah. Well, and you're just making it 10 times worse before it does. Yeah.
The issue as well was that the post office was the victim, the investigator, and the prosecutor all in one, so they were able to bypass the police and the criminal justice system. You know, there's a huge conflict of interest there. And I think in 2012, the government tried to sell post office as well. You know, So, you know, therefore, at that time, they kind of said, if we're going to sell this, you know, we can't let, you know, bidders know that there's issues with our infrastructure. So, you know, there was unfortunately huge things that they had to try and cover up.
Yeah, politics. Yeah,
to put them in their own position in terms of being sold.
Another interesting angle is the British Computer Society are kind of calling for the courts to kind of reconsider their default presumption of computer data being correct. You know, so this is again interesting. So, just interesting that there's an automatic presumption that because it's a computer's data must be right. You know.
I like that take. So that's not always the way, is it? And I think especially with just the way technology is advancing, but also cybercrime as well, it's really important now more than ever.
Yeah, it's just not the legal system, it's society in general, isn't it? If a computer says something, you know, people assume that it's right, even if it's generated by AI. Oh God, I've been having some right interesting times with AI this week. Again, I've been trying to kind of fine-tune some AI engines, you know, chatbot engines that I've built specifically for doing data protection compliance work, and they just can't get it right. You know,
have you seen Jamie's comment? I think the lesson here is that cheapest isn't always the best. Ask Everton. For those listening afterwards, Phil's not very happy.
Excuse me.
Yeah, thanks for that, Jamie. I appreciate that one. But yeah, I mean, so, you know, that's part of the debate today on third parties and the effects that it can have. But it's such a wide topic. There are, you know, there's different relationships and responsibilities throughout it all. It's, for someone who is engaging in a third party project in their organization, you know, they've got nothing in place and they need to catch up. Where do you even start?
Well, what would the GDPR have done different for this? What, you know, if this project had started under the GDPR, would there have been any difference?
Possibly. I mean, have we established then whether it was a controller processor relationship? Are we going with yes or no?
I don't think we have established.
Right. Okay. Well, if we say yes.
I'm going to vote yes.
Yes as well. So that's 2-1, Phil.
I'm the opposite. Put it to the wider vote.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's
you're
say
you're better informed than I am, but it doesn't sound like it's a, you know, let's put it a different way. This is probably an immensely complicated relationship, and maybe ICL or Fujitsu was a processor in some aspects of the project, but not necessarily for the provision of software.
Okay, well, let's say that you're letting someone, though, provide a software solution to you. And
well, it's bespoke, isn't it? So it's not like off the shelf, it's a bespoke one.
And it could impact people, you know, the way it has. You should probably understand that the software itself provides sufficient guarantees in terms of implementing technical and organizational measures to.
So had you been doing a DPIA on this, would you have identified that potentially the system might get the balances wrong? Is that one of the risks of you know how good some of the DPIAs are that you read and how detailed the risk assessment is? You know, would it have been flagged up or would there have been this presumption
carried it
that,
out, I guess.
No, it's computers. It must be right.
That highlights another important point as well, is to not, like you said earlier, not assume that the software itself is fine, whether it's a controller processor relationship or not, you know, in the context of a DPIA where it is, you've got to factor that into your risks and find mitigating factors.
And I guess it would depend on who you spoke to at Fujitsu as to whether you would consider that, because if you spoke to some of their employees, they might say, oh no, it's fine, the software is great, you know, go for it. But then, you know, there was a Fujitsu engineer that spoke on the Panorama special saying that, you know, he was very aware of the bugs and the potential implications you know, that this could have on the post office, for example, and he raised it to his manager saying that, you know, Fujitsu should get scrapped, and the manager just turned a blind eye and said, do you know how much money that and resource that would cost? So I guess whether you identify that as a risk would depend on who at the organization you'd speak to in this specific scenario.
Paul's made a really good point in the chat saying that it should have highlighted if there was remote access or support access into the live systems and the controls for allowing this.
DPIA should have done that, yeah. So maybe under the GDPR, you know, there'd been a more diverse project team. Maybe privacy might have been represented in the project rather than, well, one would assume that it wasn't. Maybe there'd have been a DPIA. Maybe there'd have been, you know, different approaches to, don't know.
Obviously, you know, this, with GDPR coming in, this should have been checked anyway, but what were the requirements in 1990, Phil? For a DPIA
DPIA got invented
2007, wasn't it?
Anything similar though?
84 Data Protection Act, which was really, really, really different from, you know, 98 was the old DPA, wasn't it, on the directive. So yes, we had a Data Protection Act, but it was very, very limited in its scope.
If I remember,
there was no such thing. The ICO invented DPIA. I think you're right, Joe. 2007.
I think so. Yeah, I think there were privacy risk assessment. They were known as back then, I think.
PIA. Privacy impact assessment.
It would be interesting to see what the 11 categories were that the government rated or categorised the platforms against. Like you say, Phil, with data protection not being much of a forethought back then, it probably wouldn't have been.
It wouldn't be now. Right, we're going out to tender. Top of the list is privacy. This doesn't happen, does it?
You see it so much with our customers. If we've got a point of contact who's the data protection leader or officer who is, you know, understands data protection and whatnot, the amount of times they get pulled into a project at the final hour saying, "Oh, we've got this, can you sign it off?" And it's like, hold on, we need to take a step back, do DPIA, understand what's actually going on with this, say, for example, this platform or software or whatnot. And it just happens all the time. I'm sure a lot of people listening can resonate with that as well.
Yeah. So go on, you were going to say.
Well, I was just saying, Manisha said in the chat that nowadays there is more due diligence work with suppliers, such as compliance and doing supplier assessments. It's, you know, that's obviously the crux of controller to processor relationships before entering into a relationship with them. But what does that actually mean? How granular do you go?
I don't think there is one particular answer to that, simply because Article 28.1 says that where process needs to be carried out on behalf of a controller, the controller shall only use processors providing sufficient guarantees. Now, that's the key, in my opinion, to implement appropriate technical organizational measures a manner that processing will meet the requirements.
And what is a guarantee? I could guarantee to you, I'm going to say, yeah, I'll do that, not a problem. I'm guaranteeing I'll do it.
Well,
what's the obligation then? Is the obligation then to double check it, to validate it, to verify it, that what I'm saying I can actually achieve?
To review it, yeah. I mean, sufficient guarantees, for starters, depends upon the type of personal data that's involved in the processing. So if you're processing, you know, name, email address for the purpose of direct marketing, the guarantees of technical and organizational measures are going to be a lot less than those if you're processing large quantities of data concerning health, for example.
Or I'm going to process sub-postmaster name, branch number and financial transactions. Does that sound onerous? Does that sound scary? Does that sound all right? Probably sounds all right.
Well, depends on the quantity, I guess. If it's nationwide, you'd probably think, you know, large processing, then you're going to want more measures in place.
You know, you might go through a great process, but still not have any red flags because of the, you know, the fact that financial information, whilst being highly sensitive and very important, isn't the special category data.
Well, yeah, it was only an example, Phil. I mean, you know, you've got to take it a bit tongue in cheek in terms of, you know, a bit more context than that. But I think in terms of, you know, what do you actually look for? Again, will depend on what you want to know, what's sufficient. You know, if you're just processing low level data, you know, you'd probably be quite content to just go on a website and have a look at the privacy policies, and if they've got anything that's public domain facing, would probably be a good inclination, a good place to start, I'd say.
Umar's asked in the chat, has there been any litigation in this area on sufficient guarantees in this context yet?
I don't think so. The ICO has been critical of a number of organizations for not doing sufficient due diligence and for having, we mentioned some, I think with North Ayrshire Council, for having a rubbish DPIA before. But I don't think there's any being any real thorough testing and analysis of what are sufficient guarantees and how do they manifest themselves. You know, arguably signing a contract is a sufficient guarantee. You know, so why don't we just accept the process of contracts? Well, that's a guarantee. That's sufficient in these circumstances. But we all seem to want to go a bit further than that, do some actual due diligence.
Because it's sufficient guarantees that technical and organisational measures in place. So in my opinion, you need to see those. You need to have a look.
And, you need to know what they are.
Yeah. And, you know, it's that those measures need to ensure that you as a controller do not infringe UK data protection law and protect the rights of the data subjects. So to me, that says that they need to have a procedure on information rights, and you need to be confident that that procedure does not infringe your rights in Chapter 3 of the UK GDPR.
I would have thought that in terms of rights, what you need to be sure is that your processor is able to notify you of any rights request that they get.
Yeah.
You don't really care if they've got their own procedures for where they're a controller, because is it relevant to the contract? I mean, surely what we're trying to say, as it's a process of contract, you know, can they meet the requirements of the contract?
But I think it goes further than that. So if you think about organizational training to be able to recognize rights or to recognize a breach to then inform the controller, it's being confident that organization has that awareness to be able to handle personal data appropriately or to fulfill the terms of that contract in full.
Yeah, and one of the terms of the contract is fairly woolly, like takes all measures required pursuant to Article 32. So, you know, what does that mean in practice? It's ill-defined, isn't it? So therefore you're back to, well, what technical organisation measures have you got in place and would we expect you to have in place?
And then obviously I think that then goes back to the types of data that's involved of what you'd expect them to have in place.
Yeah. I mean, I'm going to throw this one out here, a bit contentious, but I think potentially the weakest part of a process agreement isn't that, it's the instructions issued by the controller. I mean, how many times did you see instructions, well-formed instructions, kept up to date, monitored, managed, you know, within the context of a data process agreement? Don't know.
No, that's a good point. Umar's asked as well, how far down the chain do you go in the processor chain? So
now that's a brilliant question.
Yeah, so guarantees on processors only, not their sub-processors, right? That seems a bit onerous to go further down the chain.
And sadly, the ICO, I mean, the ICO has actually clarified this in their guidance, and it's different from the European Data Protection Board's guidance. So the ICO is saying it's your responsibility as a processor down the chain. And this isn't actually what's in the GDPR, in my opinion, but that's what's in their guidance, which I can find and post into the chat because I read it this morning. But the European Data Protection Board takes a different view. It's a bit more fudged and muddled. There's some good articles actually read about this that have been from Pinsent Masons. So I'll stick them in the chat.
You had a debate once with Vicky, didn't you, about how far down? So when you think about international transfers, you've got to implement appropriate safeguarding measures that could be adequacy of the country that you're transferring the data to in terms of their data protection legal framework. Or it could be standard contractual clauses or the data privacy framework, etc. So how far down do you go the chain in terms of international transfers and implementing safeguards? Is that onus on the processor, sub-processor relationship? And what about then any sub-sub-processors?
Yeah, you know, again, the ICO takes a different tack. You know, again, they're saying, yes, it's up to the processor to sort out any restricted transfers that they're implementing. I mean, obviously, they've got to have them approved by the controller, but this comes back to me to say, yeah, we've got that all in place. And what's the controller to say? Fine, tick in the box. Or does the controller say, prove it to me, you know, verify it to me? The ICO has said in their guidance that it's up to the processor to. And this didn't arise in the past until the definition of exporter and importer was introduced into international transfers. It was controller processor. Now we've got an exporter. So a processor could never be an exporter in the old days, but they can now. That's part of the problem.
Oh, and We've got training on international transfers if anyone wants to know more about that at the end of next month, so the 27th of Feb. If you want to inquire into that, just drop us an email at info@dataprotectionpeople.com, because it's such a complicated topic and I don't think it's one that we can really delve into now with 15 minutes to go.
It's a great topic.
It warrants its own session, to be fair. But one thing I do want to talk about is controller to controller relationships. So, you know, on the face of it, it might be quite simple. Both organizations, both parties determine the means and purposes of the processing in relation to the data that they hold. There's no requirements under the GDPR to have a data sharing agreement, you know, specified clauses within that. But again, you're meant to implement appropriate technical and organizational measures. One of those can be a data sharing agreement. So what do you include in one? That's not my main question, but what do you include in a data sharing agreement? How do you know what makes a good one and what doesn't?
I'm just typing, sorry.
I can see you're typing, so I'll throw that question to you, Joe.
I wish you wouldn't. I can't say they're my strong suit, to be honest, if you're controller to controller. It's not something that I often come across. I mean, Article 24 sets out the responsibilities of the controller, doesn't it? So, you know, it would probably not be a bad idea to include those and what each can... Is this joint controller or controller to controller, sorry?
Just controller relationships.
I mean, it's probably not a good idea to set out what each controller is responsible for in terms of, you know, responding to rights requests, notifying breaches to the ICO and data subjects, if caught. I mean, probably follow suit of Article 28 without, you know what I mean? Like loosely follow it, I guess, perhaps, you know, maybe include security measures that are in place. Obviously, you wouldn't have the infringement instruction.
What was the question?
So, just how do you go about creating a data sharing agreement? What do you include in it? Where do you start?
According to the ICO, you don't need one.
We covered that, Phil.
Oh, did you? Right, okay. Sorry about that.
Well, they say you don't need one, but they certainly help you meet the accountability principle, don't they, under Article 5.2. Yeah. So I think it would be silly not to have an agreement in place between the parties.
What if it's an ad hoc request from the police for data? So there's a whole raft of different... relationships from controller to controller, which is you've got binding corporate rules in place, you know, it's an internal transfer within the business, it's a transfer across borders within the same legal entity, it's a transfer across borders in a different legal entity but part of the same group structure. It could be an ad hoc request, it could be a regular data sharing routine, which might have a data sharing protocol in place. It could be a joint controllership. Yeah. There's just a load of different variations, and those relationships I think are different. I mean, I mentioned to Joe before the call that you might think about, well, what's the relationship I have with my outsourced DPO company? You know, how does that manifest itself? What should I be looking for in that type of relationship, or a representative or an auditor that you've engaged to come and do some auditing? These are all third party relationships I think that need some real good definition around them, personally. Yeah.
To be honest, one part of data protection in general that I just struggle to get my head around, and it's honestly, anytime I get asked it, I just wince a little bit. It's the difference between joint controllers and independent controllers, because in so many cases, you can have a case for both. And then is it a choice which one you go for? Or I don't know how to differentiate between it. I mean, I was talking with Vicky earlier this week. So she's done an audit for a customer of mine. And, you know, to briefly explain what they do. So they provide support to employees of organizations, you know, to primarily support those people, but also to promote productivity and a positive atmosphere in the workplace. So that organization will hire this company to go in twice a week, talk to the staff, and then they will produce statistics based on their findings and report those anonymous statistics back to the controller, the organization. So it could be, you know, this person, X number of people are satisfied in the workplace, X number of people are going through a hard time at home. I don't know the granularity of it, but that's overall the essence of it. Now, for some of those people, they would identify the need for a further support, and they'd open up, you know, I guess a private report and assist those people directly. They wouldn't report this information back to the organisation. It's like an added extra. So what is the relationship between both organisations here? Because they are being contracted to provide support to the other organisation's employees, but they are independently deciding what to do with that information. So is it joint or independent? It's tricky, and I don't know if it's both in different
Well, bits
instances.
Of it might. Yeah, again, yeah. Without drawing it, I'd like to draw things out so I can visualize it. But it could be that there's aspects of relationship where there's joint controllership and aspects of relationship where there's independent controllership. But what's interesting to me is I put a link into the ICO's joint controller page on their website, and they basically say, you know, that it's essentially joint controllers can be, I'm going to use the term joint and severally liable, which is not used by the ICO, but effectively they're responsible for each other. You know, if one of them goes bust and the other one carries the whole can, I mean, the ICO says, well, they can take action against each other. You know, if one pays a big fine and or compensation, then they can pursue the other one for compensation. But it seems to me that if you're in a joint control relationship, then you have to be prepared to take full responsibility for everything. You know, not necessarily a shared kind of sharing of a fine or something. Yeah. And they give some examples, you know, they do some examples on that page about joint control, the type of relationships, but again, these are fairly simplistic.
Would you say, you know, an organization that has a law firm providing legal advice, would you say that's a joint controller or independent controller relationship?
No, I haven't said it's joint control. I said it's independent. Why would it be joint? I mean, they haven't determined the means and the purpose of the processing.
True. But they're, you know,
not
one organisation.
Mutually benefiting.
They might have, because I'm thinking that they might have, you know, their own ways of dealing with that information, but for the same purpose, to, you know, reach a conclusion with a piece of information about a potential case or complaints or whatever it is. So shared interests in that sense, I would say. I just struggle with where you draw the line sometimes.
Well, that's the whole beauty of it, isn't it? I don't think so. I think what we need to do is probably write down some scenarios and put them on a spectrum. I mean, I think that it is a spectrum. I don't think that there's like Boolean type black or white. I think it's the same with processor. You know, they're definitely a processor. They're more likely to be a processor. They're more likely to not be a processor. They're more likely to be a controller. They're more likely to be a joint controller. I think there's a real spectrum. And in complex relationships, it could be the, you know, the same organizations in one relationship qualifying to different of those little pots. When we do the training side, though, we training on processes, we have a slide where it shows it as a continuum. And you, one extreme, you know, that is definitely absolutely nailed on a processor. You know, somebody doing a data cleansing exercise or sending out a mail shop for somebody. And at the other end of the spectrum, it's definitely, you know, because the ICO says it is, independent controllers like the bank. And then somewhere in the middle, you've got some grayness. And, you know, a lot of the time, you know, there's a lot of grayness, but until you write these things down and try and plot them on this continuum, I think it's a bit hard to get your head around it. So jot them down on a bit of paper.
I'll make a note.
I think the only thing that comes to my mind in terms of who would be joint controllers would probably be maybe two universities conducting research together on the same topic, as they're obviously both joining together and, you know, they're determining the means and the purposes for the process, and aren't they jointly?
Well, let me give you an example the ICO gives, right? A property management company maintains student halls of residence for the landlord, the university. The company enters the tenancy agreements with the students on the university's behalf and chases any rent arrears. It collects the rent and passes it to university after taking a commission. The company is a joint controller of the tenancy-related information, including the rental payments. It decides what information it needs from the residents to set up and manage tenancies, but will share this data with the university. Again, I have to look at these use cases, and also the European Data Protection Board have got some good use cases in their guidance, and you have to just kind of plot it on the thing. And then, but in reality, you know, there could be a much more complex relationship than is described on that example. And then bits of that relationship might be, oh, actually they're a processor because that's providing a hosted system. And bits of it might be they're actually an independent controller because they're going off and doing credit checking for their own purposes, or trying to sell them another product independently of the university. That's the problem, isn't it? The reality of when your boots are on the ground are, it isn't necessarily that clear cut.
Kaylee said in the chat, if the third party does the separate processing, so the individual may provide their data directly to them rather than through the company, and the third party would then have a separate direct relationship with that individual, would the relationship between the company and the third party be controlled to controller?
It might well be. I mean, but what are the implications of that? That's the key, isn't it? So privacy information, lawful grounds for processing, you know, a whole host of other responsibilities that come with being a sole controller of that data.
Going back a little bit, Vicky's commented in the chat. So she said, I'm dealing with a case currently looking at TikTok. They store UK data in all of their data centers in USA, Ireland and Singapore, all run by third parties, but UK companies contract with TikTok UK. When you upload data to TikTok, it is sent to one of their servers and so is physically outside of the UK, but TikTok don't tell you who the third party storage providers are for you to check it out. As the agreement is with TikTok UK, is there a restricted transfer taking place? Whose responsibility is it to put the appropriate safeguards in place?
So are these independent companies part of TikTok UK? Because if it's all part of the same legal entity, the ICA would say there's no restricted transfer. That's first point, isn't it? If they're not part of TikTok UK, the ICA would say there is a restricted transfer taking place. It's my initial shooting from the hip.
Yeah, okay. That one's gone over my head a little bit, to be honest, because I was reading it out.
I think it's data centers that don't belong to TikTok by the reason of that. So it's like third parties that have data centers in the US, Ireland, and Singapore. Yeah. So yeah, maybe like AWS, for example.
But if
the US, Ireland, and Singapore. Yeah.
But surely it is anyway. If they're based, you know, if they're a multinational organization, then they will be required to, you know, implement safeguards between.
If they're separate
entities, internally, yeah. Anyway, yeah.
Yeah, so it was like TikTok US, TikTok Ireland, TikTok Singapore, TikTok UK. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, but I can't even imagine. I mean, just where the data centers are based. If it's a UK organization, but I don't know how it works internally. If they've got their own data center, so if they use like AWS or whatnot.
I think if it's the same entity, like Phil says, the ICO considers it not to be a. It's if they're separate legal entities is when it's restricted transfer.
So almost AWS like a member of staff.
So if you have like a subsidiary.
Vicky's got her hand up. If you had TikTok Singapore, a separate legal entity to TikTok UK, restricted transfer. If TikTok UK has a building in Singapore full of servers and
it's not
owned and run by TikTok UK, not restricted transfer.
Okay. Yeah, like you'd have a member of staff working in another country, just make sure that you've got appropriate measures in place from a security perspective rather than
TikTok France. Different scenario. Because the European Data Protection Board takes a different view. Vicky's got her hand up. She's going to come in and clarify the whole thing for you.
Yeah, no, from my understanding, I think they've got data centres, say, in the US, Singapore and Ireland, which are run by third parties. But the data, when you upload data to TikTok, it doesn't go through TikTok. It just gets sent straight to their server, say, in the US. But the contract is with TikTok UK. So do you have to put appropriate safeguards in place with that third party as you, the exporter, and then the importer? Or is that the responsibility of TikTok?
Yeah, again, this is the ICO on their on the guidance notes that we've talked about in this session. They are highlighting these kind of scenarios, Vicky, where they're saying that the data flows don't necessarily follow the contractual flows, which we found all the way through, you know, you've got a contract between two entities, but the data flows to a third entity, which isn't directly contracted to the first entity. It's a subprocessor or a processor of the second entity. My view is that you have to follow the data flows in order to get to the bottom of whether there's a restricted transfer going down. But I think I'm in a minority because the ICO's view is that you follow the contracts.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard when they won't tell you what company is that's actually holding the data, what third party. On their website, it just says third parties and service providers. So you can't contact anybody to put a contract in place if you don't know who they are.
You should make a complaint.
See how that goes.
What's this? TikTok covering their tracks, are they, again, with data
perception?
Well,
either they don't know how, you know, the data, where the data is. Maybe there's some way of load banding and it's, you know, below balancing it, and they can't control that. Or maybe they do know and they don't want to tell you. Who knows? But nobody will find out unless somebody's prepared to step up and take action, Vicky Lawson.
Well, I think
thank
that...
you.
That wasn't really the answer Vicky was looking for, I don't think, Phil, but
all right.
So that is the hour anyway. Thank you, everyone, for joining this session. We hope you enjoyed it. It will be available online or through all major streaming platforms, hopefully by the end of today, if not by the end of Monday. If you want to know any more information about what we do or anything like that, email us at info@dataprotectionpeople.com, and if you've got any suggestions for future sessions. And I think we'll be having a part two, so let us know if you would like that as well. I've decided. but I think we need one. And yeah, thank you, Phil and Joe, for joining me. It's been a good session.
Very good. Cheers. Have a great weekend. Thank you very much.
Cheers, guys.
See you later. Oh, Amy's got a hand up. And it's gone. All right, see you later.